Health advice is everywhere online, TikTok, Instagram, YouTube. There's no shortage of self-styled experts and wellness influencers who are ready to give you advice and take your money. The trouble is, even when we hear the horror stories of bad advice and shameless grifters, we keep consuming it. We used to put our faith or anxiety into Dr. Google. Earlier this year, OpenAI revealed there are 230 million health and wellness queries on ChatGPT every week. And our social media algorithms have built in confirmation biases that show us content we're likely to be interested in. But who are the people we're turning our trust over to? And when we turn to the algorithm for answers about our health, how do we know what's medicine and what's marketing? Here with me is Dr. Deb Cohen, a health and science journalist who has gone deep into how this is playing out for people in the United Kingdom, where she's from. Her new book is called Bad Influence: How the Internet Hijacked Our Health. Deb Cohen, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
So we had Dr. Google. They're old now, a couple of decades old. There's Dr. TikTok, Dr. YouTube, even Dr. AI. Why are we going to the internet and not to an actual doctor?
Well, it's a really good question. And I think there's context specific. So I looked at a few countries. I looked at the UK, US, sort of largely the West, really. And the reasons why we go there are all similar things, but obviously, depending on the context of your health service, there'll be slight differences. So, for example, in the UK, you might have heard about the headlines about our National Health Service with really long waits and perhaps people not being able to get an appointment with their GP. So there's a gap there that's created. In the United States, for example, people mightn't be able to afford to get access to healthcare. So there are all sorts of reasons, and there is a global shortage of healthcare professionals, and healthcare systems around the world are struggling. So that's one reason. They can't get access, so they turn online. There's another view, actually, that sometimes they don't feel heard or validated by the health professionals. And that was something I came up repeatedly. I interviewed over 200 people for the book, and that was just a similar refrain. And then if you think about it, if you get that information online, and you know that Dr. Google's been happening for years, but there are slight differences with social media that do make a difference to how we consume information and think about it. But if you're a doctor, often half your appointment might be taken up with correcting all the misinformation, if you like. And I'm not a fan of that term. You've heard online before. You can actually sit down and impart information. And that's a bit of a vicious circle. So then perhaps you haven't got time with somebody talking to them about things that you might want to talk about, or time to listen so much. So that's another one. And then you've mentioned it as well, medical misogyny. And by way of example, women's health has been massively underfunded. The National Institute of Health in America only mandated women could be in clinical trials in 1993. That was the same year Jurassic Park came out. So there's a big gap in women's health, and there was more money spent on erectile dysfunction than there was on broadly women's health, and that's everything from menopause and periods through to pregnancy and childbirth and other specific women's issues. And repeatedly women say they don't feel heard and they don't feel seen. So there's a whole spectrum of reasons.
You talked a bit about women there. I'm wondering, when you said you were talking to these 200 people you interviewed for your book and you sort of heard this refrain of people not feeling heard, were there other groups that stood out to you as being more likely to say that than others?
I think young people, I think largely, and this is a UK perspective here, but actually the United States as well. One question I have, and I don't know the answer to because there's an absence of evidence, is how is social media, and we'll see it with the large language models like ChatGPT and so on, how is this shaping our perception of healthcare? What is it doing to expectations? If we are told this is what good care looks like and an influencer, for example, can give us all this attention, what does that do to trust in the health profession or our health services? So It's interesting because, and this is the UK perspective, young people have least faith in the NHS, and that gets and it improves as you get older. But anecdotally, I've never heard so many people say, and it's not just the NHS, it's they're not satisfied with their doctor. Now, some of that might be a proxy for the National Health Service because a lack of time, a lack of access. But there's a lot of careful unpicking to do here. I hear, you know, and this is some of my age group, perimenopausal women who say, ugh, my medical, traditional medical care is awful. I much prefer what I get at this growing number of private menopause clinics, say, for example, or services offering things that often lack an evidence base. So it's sort of a... And then you've got another cluster, actually, and that is, you know, the people that might listen to the Joe Rogan podcast, the longevity types that think traditional medicine moves too slowly and they want to get in there and try all these treatments and tests and body scans that they think are going to make a difference, but your regular doctor doesn't know about them because they're not in guidelines, largely because there's an absence of evidence. So there's little pockets all around, really, but certainly in the UK, younger generations, and I think some of that is the pandemic where people couldn't get access, the services were closed down or everything turned online. And also, if you do everything in the palm of your hand and a phone, why wouldn't you do healthcare on your phone? So there's all these little trends going on at the same time.
So talk to me about, some of this is site specific. You talked about the NHS, or the situation in the US as well. Obviously, we have our own little version of that here in Australia, but online it's a very global marketplace. What kind of techniques are health influencers using to gain our trust online?
There's something called parasocial relationships, and you're absolutely right to mention about this global marketplace. One issue I'm actually looking at for the British Medical Journal at the moment, and I do touch on it in the book, is the ban on direct-to-consumer advertising on prescription drugs. And I know Australia has that ban too. I think New Zealand doesn't, the United States doesn't. But actually, the firewalls about what's marketed are breaking down because of social media. So we can get, we see prescription drugs being promoted online. They are American, but because the firewalls aren't always robust, you can see it in the UK. And there's other ways as well. And this is what's really important. It's something called parasocial relationships. So, for example, the drug industry in the United States uses patient influencers, and they don't always declare the conflicts of interest. So they might be talking about a drug, but we won't know it's an ad because it's not declared. And what patient influencers do and other influencers is they develop these relationships, and they're very one-sided. So because they're in your phone, it's quite an intimate space, isn't it? It's like where you talk to your family, you might FaceTime them or do a WhatsApp video call. They're in your phone and they're talking at you, and they talk in your language to build up trust. You look at the homes, you might see messy homes behind, or, you know, there's the old classic, you know, female trope with hairband on and putting your makeup on while you're imparting serious facts. But and so it builds up this sense of intimacy, and they might respond to direct messages under Instagram posts or TikTok or on YouTube and build that into their next video. And in fact, the podcasters that, you know, the Andrew Hubermans of the world and the Joe Rogans and the Peter Attias, these are massive American podcasters, but their reach is global. They do that very same thing as well. And they will respond to queries and bring it up in the podcast. So you feel you've been heard and listened to. That's very different from the old celebrity endorsements that were quite distant. You might see an advert for Adidas or Nike with a sports star. And then there's a new term that I only heard recently, is trans parasocial relationships. And they're when they drop into your direct messages. And that's very hard for regulators to regulate. They can't see what's going on in DMs. And that's a real big currency for marketers, if you can get an influencer interacting with one of their followers in the DM.
You are listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Dr. Deb Cohen, a health and science journalist whose new book is called Bad Influence: How the Internet Hijacked Our Health. I am interested to know what this looks like for you. What kind of health advice is showing up in your feed, whether you've ever been tempted to act on it or acted on it? Paula says, if for some reason I'm wondering about an ailment, I don't ask my friend who has no medical knowledge, so why would I seek out a stranger with no medical qualifications? Evidence-based medicine only. If you want to go online, seek out medical websites, not social media. Another person says there's also a lack of funding for men's mental health. Doctors don't have time to see you for long or for more than a single issue. I've used AI for holistic care, asking questions like, can you research how losing weight is different for people with ADHD and come up with some tools and goals? Well, Deb, you mentioned this idea of regulation, how hard it is. The internet is so big, any single country trying to regulate it feels impossible. What is the way through here?
It's really, really tricky. And I think it's on lots of different levels. So some of it, for example, and I know researchers at the University of Sydney, like Brooke Nicol and Kirsten McCaffrey and Tessa Kopp, have looked at this, the promotion of testing. Now, some of that might be market failure. Should those tests be even sold in the first place? So there is a question in healthcare, what should and shouldn't be sold? We live in free countries. Perhaps that's okay. Well, people should have evidence-based advice about what they can and can't tell you. Governments have a role, and I know about your ban in Australia on smartphones. But then there's the platforms as well. And what's interesting is when they governments do clamp down on them, they can act. So, for example, and I talk about this in the book, when there was the question over TikTok being, you know, banned in the United States, Joe Biden and continued under Donald Trump, TikTok started removing weight loss content because they wanted to show themselves as being, ethical and proper. Mm. And so they can do it. And when Donald Trump came into power, and there was the overturning of Roe versus Wade, which was the constitutional right in the United States for a woman to have an abortion. Meta started, and they deny this allegation, but it's been raised by Democrat senators and also charities themselves. Charities that offer morning after pill were being shadow banned, which meant you couldn't see any of their posts. So they can do it. And in the Europe, in the EU, and obviously the UK is not part of the EU anymore, but when they saw that Lady Gaga had been promoting a migraine drug, a prescription-only migraine drug, and it could be seen in Europe, European officials started clamping down and saying to Meta, this isn't allowed. And now that is restricted. It's restricted now in the UK, but it wasn't. So governments can act, but it is vast. And even then, it requires people to raise concerns themselves. So in many ways, we're all responsible for each other. And what I saw in the UK were doctors where they saw a legal promotion of Wegovy and Ozempic, the GLP-1 drugs, and Mounjaro. They were reporting that to our regulators, and they were then taking it down. So some people in many ways have become police. And there's another story I talk about in the book. Chelsea Polis, who's an academic in America, who started targeting some of the fertility tracking apps that were claiming to be contraceptives. And she went after them. So we all sort of have a stake in the game, really.
So there's some kind of guerrilla policing happening behind the scenes. Is there also maybe a way of using this powerful force for good and not for evil, like promoting positive health information online? I know that some doctors are on social media trying to correct that. Is that part of the solution too?
Absolutely. And I know you've got some in Australia as well, some doctors who are in the space. Absolutely. I interviewed a few of them in the book, and one of them in the UK, Adam Fox, is a paediatric allergist. And there was a well-known baby author in the UK, And she said to him, look, you might go on morning TV, you might be at your conferences, but you need to be on Instagram because that's where a lot of your young parents are. So he does videos and has his own page full of videos. And when he's in clinic, he says, look, I might not have time to tell you everything you need to know, but I've got a video on this. Go and look at Instagram. And that's, you know, here's my feed. And that's one way of doing it, because I think whereas health professionals, we fall down sometimes is we don't speak that language, or the websites that we give or present aren't always in the language that people are used to speaking. So I think there's a mix of how we present information as well. But one of the problems, I think, for people that just automatically assume if you're a medic or a doctor or a health professional online, they're also promoting stuff themselves sometimes, not all of the time. And we have to be mindful of their conflicts of interest. What products are they selling? Have they got a private clinic that they want to promote? And sometimes that's okay, but is that clinic offering evidence-based interventions? So doctors online aren't automatically a total panacea to the churn of marketing information that we see online. I basically considered, by the time I wrote the book and I started with a very open mind, I thought this is what happens when you put health on platforms that are there for shopping and entertainment, which is essentially what they're powered for. And I've sort of called it the commodified self. If you can measure it, you can sell it. If you can measure a biomarker, you can sell it. And one trope is, we're going to tell you you're broken, and these are the tests you need to do, and this is the protocol to fix it. And it's easy to have your own clinic online in many ways. You can be a coach, you can offer supplements, you can promote tests. The old barriers are gone. And that there's positives with that, but there's also challenges with it as well.
Deb, briefly, what do you hope people take away from this message that you're saying to me today and in your book? What sort of tool would you like people to take with them next time they're online?
I think there's fascinating work going on at the University of New South Wales with Kate Fass and her team, looking at how social media is shaping what we think about our symptoms and things as well. So first of all, what you see isn't neutral. It's your algorithms, which we know are opaque. And what you're actually seeing might be making you feel a certain thing. It might be influencing how you perceive. So being aware of that. Then also, why is someone on the platform? Why is someone telling you something? Now, it might be absolutely perfectly legitimate and people want to help and share their information and think they're helping people. But as a journalist, we always think, why is this person telling me this now? So it's a little bit of skepticism. Think about, is this person trying to sell me something? What are they gaining? And I'm not talking being really nihilistic. It's just having that little bit of healthy skepticism. If they're telling me about the benefits of something, why aren't they telling me about the harms? What are the harms? If they've got a powerful story, recognize it as being an anecdote and perhaps as a broader evidence base. And there's an acronym that the Academy of Royal Medical Colleges in the UK were promoting, and it's called BRAN. So the B stands for benefits, the R stands for risks, the A stands for alternatives, N is what happens if I do nothing. And they're the questions you think about, as well as, why is this person telling me this or giving me this information now? What's their incentive?
Deb, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been fascinating talking to you.
Dr. Deb Cohen is a good influence, the author of Bad Influence, How the Internet Hijacked Our Health. The book is out in Australia this month. This feels like as good a time as any to mention I have another podcast. It's called What's That Rash, in which I and Dr. Norman Swan give evidence-based answers to the health questions everyone's asking. Just trying to help cut through here. You can search What's That Rash on ABC Listen for that one.
ABC RN helps you understand the world. Find more of our stories on the ABC Listen app.